Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. As always, I want to welcome you, whether you are a first-time listener or someone who's been listening for a while. I mean it. I really appreciate that you're here. I love that you tune in. And I just want to say to people, like, you listening means everything to me because this is something I do that I'm passionate about. And I hope that if you're listening, you get something out of each and every show. You might not get something out of each and every show, but I hope that there are shows you do relate to and that there's some helpful content. And today, we have a really amazing guest, someone who knows the pain personally and professionally about not feeling like they look sick enough or being dismissed by doctors. Dr. Aaron Harrop is an assistant professor at the University of Denver, a licensed medical social worker, and a leading researcher on eating disorders, weight stigma, and inclusive healthcare. Their work centers around marginalized communities, including people in higher weight bodies, BIPOC communities, queer and trans folks, and people with limited access to care. And what I love about Aaron is that they don't just study this, they lived it. They understand on a cellular level what it's like to be severely ill and still not believed. And in our conversation, we talk about what happens when you're told you're not sick enough. And we're gonna talk about why atypical or anorexia is one of the most misunderstood and underdiagnosed eating disorders, and how weight stigma in medicine quietly determines who gets care and who gets ignored. We're also going to dig into real stories of medical bias, being pushed out of treatment too soon, and what to do when professionals minimize your symptoms because of your body size. And most importantly, Aaron shares practical strategies for advocating for yourself inside of the system that too often gets it wrong. This episode will challenge what you think about eating disorders, and it might just give you words for something you've been struggling to explain. So, all that being said, let's go dive in. All right, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I know it's been a long time coming, so I'm really excited you're here. And I ask all my guests this, but if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about maybe your own journey and how you got into this field and working in eating disorders, I'd really love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I, like many of us in the eating disorders field, came to this because of my own lived experience with an eating disorder. I was someone who experienced an eating disorder kind of in childhood and adolescence. And when it was finally recognized for what it was as an eating disorder, I was in a place where my family didn't have insurance. We didn't have easy access to healthcare. And so trying to figure out, like, what do we do with this life-changing illness? How do we manage this? And how do we do that with very limited resources and pretty much no eating disorder specialists? That experience of needing care, becoming quite sick quite quickly, and then really being in a place with my whole family of what do we do? That pretty much changed the trajectory of my life, I think. At the time, as an adolescent, this was the biggest thing I'd ever experienced. And I kind of made a promise to myself in high school that, like, this is what I wanted to do with my life. And if I could make a difference for other kids, other teens who were going through experiences like this, mm-hmm. that I wanted to do something to make eating disorder treatment better, more accessible, and yeah, more freely available to families like mine that were lower income and just didn't have access. So that's what I did.
That's
it took
awesome.
Me a while to end up in the field that I am now, but now I'm primarily a researcher, but I do have my foot in clinical. So I do a little bit of clinical work with an eating disorder treatment center. And then I also research interventions that are also aimed at making eating disorder treatment more available to people that kind of aren't able to access treatment through kind of the traditional ways of accessing treatment.
That is so needed. And I'm so sorry you experienced that, because I know there are a lot of barriers to treatment, mm-hmm. and not only just finding a specialist, but affording it, finding mm-hmm. care.
Yep.
And not even knowing what kind of care. I know I've talked about that on here before, but just, mm-hmm. I think it's just, you get the diagnosis and then this, what's next? Where do we go from here? It's scary too.
I've been a guinea pig in many types of treatment before, I think, before being able to find something that worked well for me.
Thank you for doing all of that work too. Like, what did you find hurdles even trying to get that going and started, and like
the research or the treatment?
The treatment, like not neuro treatment, but trying to like open doors for other people once you were trying to start all of this.
Absolutely. In general, things are better than when I was a teen. We have mental health parity now. At the time when I was a teenager, our health insurance was just like, or we didn't have health insurance, but like, when you went to the ER or something, like they would only stabilize the physical problem, right? They didn't do anything mentally. And now we have some laws in place that protect mental health the way that we also protect physical health. But those laws are still not strong when it comes to getting involved before a patient is very life-threateningly ill. And so I've definitely struggled. I was a pediatric social worker, and I saw a lot of adolescent patients with eating disorders. And oftentimes the message that we told kids and families was like, go home, get sicker, and come back. Especially if these were adolescents or children that were on public forms of assistance, like Medicaid, things like that. It's just very difficult to find treatment centers that are contracted with Medicaid, to find specialists that will work with Medicaid patients. And then also trying to get like the appropriate level of care, particularly for patients that might not look as sick. I think that has been a never-ending struggle. And patients often know, well, we know and we don't know, right? Patients often know that we need help. We might not be looking forward to getting that help. We might be a little resistant to that help, but we often know and have some willingness. But if the system can't meet us where we're at and connect us to resources during that kind of window of opportunity, I've seen a lot of patients get worse instead of better.
Yeah, so picking up on that, like you said, when they may not, quote unquote, have that look, right? That's such a, let's talk about that, because that's not just, that's across the board, I think. Mm-hmm. I found that a lot too, people in their personal lives and when they go for care.
Yeah.
There's this stigma of what an eating disorder looks like, or mm-hmm. what you look like when you're sick. And what are your experiences with that?
I think like interpersonally, like you're talking about, like with family members or with friends, one, people think that eating disorders aren't that big of a deal in general, mm-hmm. right? Maybe it's something that like, oh, everybody feels a little bad about their body during adolescence, or mm-hmm. everybody diets a little bit. I think there can be a lot of minimization of eating disorder symptoms in general. And when that's paired with someone whose body does not look skeletal or extremely thin, there can be a lot of denial that, one, that person even has an eating disorder, or two, that eating disorder could be very serious and very life-threatening for that person. I think for me, just based on my personal experience, I had an eating disorder that in some parts of my life I presented as very thin, worrisomely thin for somebody who was looking at my body. And other times, particularly after puberty had hit and after I was an adult and in an adult's body, where because my body is naturally a bit heavier, when I experienced those resurgences of symptoms and I again went through those periods of self-starvation, it wasn't noticeable to people in the same way as when I was in a thinner body and when I was in a smaller body, even though I was having the same symptoms, the same behaviors, even the same like cardiac condition in both size bodies. The fact that looked larger when I was presenting as an adult for eating disorder care than when I was presenting for as a teen, I think that that impact how much concern there was, and also it impacted the treatment I received too, in terms of actual providers who specialize in eating disorders in higher levels of care that treat severe eating disorders, where personally I experienced my eating disorder minimized and received what I now know was like detrimental care because of how they interpreted my eating disorder and how they interpreted my body. And I've seen that now as a researcher. I've seen that over and over in the research participants that I work with. As a clinician, I see that over and over in the care that my patients receive, where if a patient gains weight too quickly in treatment, insurance wants to cut off. As if gaining weight somehow magically fixes someone's mind, which is not to underestimate the amount of importance of nutrition in the process. But I think most of us with eating disorders know that it's a long time from after we gain weight where our minds and our cognitions and our body image starts to actually heal.
That's even, I think, the most like needed time for people to need treatment, because that is the biggest fear and biggest personal hurdle I think people have. Like when I post, like, what's the hesitancy in seeking treatment, or what do you think about seeking treatment? People are like, fine, treat my eating disorder, but I don't want my body to change. I've quote unquote worked so hard to get here, or I'm afraid of gaining, because that's part of the eating disorder, right? Yep. That's part of the diagnostic criteria of gaining weight, right? Imagine, right? And maybe some of you listening can relate to this. You've gone into treatment, your body's changing, you have more nutrition in your body, your brain's more online, so you're thinking and feeling, mm-hmm. and you're more aware of your body, which mm-hmm. feels very foreign, right? And to your point, you get cut off from treatment.
Yeah.
You're being covered, and that's the time you need it the most.
Yeah. And we see this happen over and over with treatment centers and insurance companies, where people will gain, and often it's not even the full amount of weight that this person might need to regain in order to actually sustain recovery. Maybe they're just partially on their way, but it's happened. And as your body starts to heal and you get that nutrition on board, it's like your emotions get turned up, right? Instead of being in this place of feeling numb and feeling disconnected and having a fair amount of kind of depressed apathy, or at least that was my experience, all of a sudden that emotional volume knob gets switched on at the very same time that we're introducing patients to having a body that looks different and feels different. And not only does it look and feel different if this person didn't have an eating disorder, but this person also probably has an intense fear of fatness, a lot of internalized weight stigma, a lot of internalized thin idealization. And so even whatever changes they've experienced, they're probably experiencing that with a magnifying glass, with this volume on their emotions turned up. And then in the midst of like their greatest fears being realized in terms of their body changing or having some weight regain, that's when the insurance company, time to push you down to outpatient. And I over and over we see, I'm laughing just because it's ridiculous, not because it's funny, but I see it over and over where patients get pushed out too quickly and then they're back in their lives without support with these harder emotions and living in fear now with this unhealed relationship with their body. And so of course it makes sense that eating disorder coping mechanism is right there ready to catch them.
Right. And also I find, because I do outpatient, right, what I see is people getting discharged and not having much support on the outside, because a lot of the triggers that contributed to the eating disorder in the first place, the depression or anxiety, were not there in residential with a more contained environment. And people might make comments because of their own ideas about
Yeah.
To your point, like weight stigma and things. Yeah. And if comments are made that are not supportive because people don't understand, yeah. it's like a double whammy. And so mm-hmm. without patient, of course, like trying to talk about like more than once a week or mm-hmm. people are really hesitant to continue because, okay, I'll talk about another hurdles. It's expensive. And mm-hmm. for the most part, outpatient's not covered.
Yeah.
That's scary too. Yeah. And so it's like, people are just left hanging, and also the lack of eating disorder specialists on the outside, which mm-hmm. is a thing too. And I don't know what you find in Colorado, but I'd be interested to hear about that too.
Yeah, I think it's a problem almost everywhere in terms of having, and not just having specialists, but having specialists who are trained to like truly support eating disorders in a lot of different diverse identities and backgrounds mm-hmm. and to be able to recognize what an eating disorder looks like when it doesn't look like the textbook vignette of what we're taught the stereotype of eating disorders are. And so I think there's mm-hmm. we definitely have a shortage of providers who are trained, who know kind of evidence-based practices and who can work with a wide variety of people and get folks to that place, like you're saying, of full recovery. I think sometimes too, there's like that recovery fatigue. We've been working at this for so long. And if that insurance company is, you're good now. I think sometimes I want to be like, cool, I'm good now. And just, this is hard work. Can we be done for a minute? And I know at least for me, that eating disorder doesn't let up. Like it's a very persistent voice. And I am a person I've learned that I have to stay really on top of it, or mm-hmm. if I give a little bit of ground, I can very quickly find myself back in a toxic cycle or some kind of pattern around mm-hmm. food and body avoidance that can get me very quickly back into that eating disorder. I know that's not everyone's experience. Some people have right. a very different recovery journey, but for me, I've had to stay engaged and connected mm-hmm. to treatment teams for decades, and I'm okay having those regular check-ins to kind of just the little mm-hmm. tune-up on your car, like getting your oil changed kind yeah. of thing.
No, but that's wise, and it's good to know that about mm-hmm. yourself. And I don't think we even talk about that, too. I think a lot of us with eating disorders, we're perfectionists, so mm-hmm. it's like having to do it perfectly or right. And so if you're cut off being told, like, okay, you're done, it's, wait, mm-hmm. I even failed at this. And so yeah. that can be even bringing on more shame or mm-hmm. more, wait, what did I do wrong? Or whatever it is that goes on in your head.
Or it can give you this view of recovery that is still quite influenced by your eating disorder, right? Where you're in this kind of partial state of, some of these things have gotten better. I'm eating more regularly. My hunger cues are starting to come back on board again. I'm medically stable. But maybe I still have a lot of body avoidance, and I still have a lot of body shame, and I still have a really loud negative voice in my head. But maybe I think that this is as good as it gets right. because they told me that I'm well, or they told me that I'm healthy or no longer worthy of treatment. Yeah. And so I think we can do ourselves a disservice of the kind of life we could live with a bit more healing. And honestly, we don't know about that healing until we experience it. And it can be hard to hold out that hope for something that maybe we don't even know is possible.
Yeah, especially, and I've said this on here many times for anyone who's listened, but I think there is still that myth that I'm always going to have to struggle with this. Right? Mm-hmm. It's never going to fully go away, really. And that's powerful if you believe that.
Yeah. And so, for me, I think that was a belief that I had for a long time that I needed to grieve, right? I needed to grieve what my eating disorder had took from me, mm-hmm. like the adolescent years I wouldn't get back, the college yeah. years I wouldn't get back, the time away from my family that I had to spend in treatment, and the many thousands of dollars and hours and time that I had to devote to this, quite frankly, very boring part of my life, rather than investing in other cooler hobbies. And then after that grief of maybe this doesn't get better, that opened up the door for, okay, what does recovery look like? If maybe it's not this picture perfect, beautiful butterfly, I went into the treatment cocoon and I came out this completely healed butterfly. If that wasn't my experience, then what's a more realistic view of what recovery looks like for me? And how do I even hold hope for those places of recovery that I don't think are possible for me, but might be? And how do I work towards them in case they are? Because if they are possible, like, I want to get there.
Yeah. And gosh, yeah. And having so much compassion too, mm-hmm. for the fact that we live in this world, like you're talking about with weight stigma and all of these things, and having potentially running into doctors, which is common, that have their own weight biases. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to talk about that a little bit in terms of, you can't look at somebody and know if they have an eating disorder, mm-hmm. or if they're malnourished, or mm-hmm. what's going on. And a lot of times people just, doctors included, oftentimes will look at somebody and make their own conclusions. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that, but.
Yeah, I'm super passionate about weight stigma and study it also because of this work, right? Because of how I've encountered it. Interestingly enough, like the first places I actually encountered weight stigma personally was within eating disorder treatment, right? Where the providers around me assumed that my diagnosis was different than it was, assumed that my behaviors were different than they were, assumed I was underreporting what I ate versus being accurate in what I was eating, or sometimes even exaggerating what I was eating, right? Because I was trying to make it sound like I was doing better than I was at different points. And seeing that contrast of how some providers treated me, like eating disorder specialists, compared to how I was treated in a thinner body, was that first like awakening moment for me of, oh, this is what people in larger bodies experience in terms of weight stigma with doctors. Like, I had heard about that happening before. I had loved ones who had been impacted by weight stigma in medicine, but I had never experienced it directed towards myself because I'd always been in a body that had thin privilege at other points in my eating disorder. So it was a little startling to all of a sudden like start having those experiences now that it wasn't a family member or a friend who was experiencing this. It was directly happening to me. And I have had since that time, just in kind of general medical care, I am pretty picky about the doctors that I see, and I do quite a bit of screening myself in terms of talking with a new primary care provider, telling them about my eating disorder history and the fact that I do want to receive weight-inclusive care. And that's, at this point, it's life-threatening when I don't have that, and mm-hmm. I've learned that. But I've interacted when I was pregnant with my kiddo. I interacted with an obstetrician who, you know, I think it was a week after I'd given birth to my son, recommended like diet and weight loss for me. And I was dealing with the baby in the NICU. I had just had a C-section. I was in the middle of my like just acute postpartum recovery period. And to hear like that was his priority for me amidst all of these other things. I don't even think I got screened for depression at that visit, but it was just this flippant comment about watching what I ate and exercising more and losing weight. And he didn't know how I ate. He didn't know how I moved my body. I played competitive volleyball until the week before I was in the hospital for my kiddo. Like, he didn't know any of those things about me. And so I think about those instances, and for me, that was hugely impactful because mm-hmm. it was one of the first times that a clinician who didn't know much about me, who was just seeing me as a follow-up patient, made that kind of recommendation for me. And since then, luckily, it hasn't happened to me very many times, probably because I'm in a middle fat body. I'm not a large or super fat person. So my body size, like, I can still sometimes shop at a regular clothing store, but I need the largest sizes. Plus size clothing stores are a little better for me at this point. But I do still have some size privilege. And I know that if I were in a larger body, I would get these comments more. And I've also had the experience of seeking medical care and being told that I couldn't have that medical care until my BMI was lower. And I had the experience of a doctor like recommend bariatric surgery for me without knowing about my eating disorder history, without even asking about my eating disorder history, and without even asking what I ate, how much I ate, how I moved my body, or what my weight history was. There's so many things that they didn't know before making this kind of flippant recommendation. And for me, for someone who has a history of anorexia, to be given that medical recommendation of having my stomach amputated was very damaging. And it could have triggered a relapse.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. I'm curious, like when you were being told these things, did you have anything to say, or were you just so much in shock you just walked out and didn't say anything?
In that instance with the doctor who recommended bariatric surgery, I was able to speak back, which is shocking. With the first doctor, when I was postpartum, I just started crying and left and never saw him again. And I've since wondered about, I've thought about reaching back out to him and just writing a little note, letting him know about my experience, trying to evoke some empathy from him, because I know he will meet with many other postpartum moms who maybe they don't have a history of anorexia, but maybe being told to lose weight the week after they gave birth is not number one on the priority list from the doctor. With this other physician, when she gave, it was interesting because when she gave the recommendation, she had my medical history forms. I had actually refused to be weighed in her office. So like when they took me, this was an intake appointment. When they took me back, I said, you know what? I don't really feel like stepping on the scale today. And they'd given me some pushback. We need this number in order to figure out whatever. And I was like, you can have it maybe later if I feel like it. One of those kind of conversations. And so she actually gave me the recommendation without knowing my weight either, which is an interesting medical choice, right? So she would have just been eyeballing me at this point when she was giving me this referral to the bariatric clinic. And she did have my medical history form, so she knew about the length of my eating disorder. She knew about my history of cardiac and kidney failure from the anorexia. So she knew that it had been significant. And when she gave me the referral, she actually said, it's our clinic policy for me to give you this referral. I don't think that it is necessarily wise in your case, given your medical history, but I'm required by policy to give this to you.
Wow.
And so in some ways that softened the blow because I knew that she didn't think it was an okay medical recommendation. In other ways, and so she opened the door and I responded and I was like, it's really interesting that you are giving me medical advice and referrals for something that you don't actually think would be useful for me. And I was really curious. I did not ask her, but I was curious, like, how does that feel as a provider? If I, as a provider, was forced to engage in a therapy that I truly believed was detrimental for a patient, I don't know how long I could work at that clinic.
Yeah.
Especially with something like an eating disorder or weight stigma, something that we know is dangerous, so life-threatening. And in my case, like very real life-threatening in terms of my actual medical history. Yeah. We had a brief conversation based because I was like, given my medical history, could you advocate for an exception for me to your clinic's policy, right? Why? Basically, I was trying to come alongside her and be like, can we fight this together kind of thing. We did a little bit of brainstorming in terms of different ways I could get my body weight down a couple BMI points for one measurement so that I could qualify for the procedure that I was needing. And ultimately, I was like, all of these things are just going to reactivate my eating disorder. And I say get it down a few BMI points because she didn't know my weight, but I knew how close I was. And so it was once she told me their cutoff. And the only reason why I'd gone to their clinic is because when I'd called them ahead of time, I'd asked them if they had BMI limits because many clinics have BMI limits around certain types of care, like knee surgeries or gender-affirming care or fertility treatments, those types of things. And I'd been told that their clinic did not have BMI limits. But in between when I got in for an appointment and when I'd called to schedule, they were bought by a different company and they had BMI limits introduced. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And that still sticks in my mind, right? Luckily, I was able to find a different place that did not have limits on their care. And that was really important. But I wish I hadn't had to go through that experience to get there.
That's horrible. I'm so sorry. It also just brings to mind, well, I can't remember when exactly it was, but do you remember when like the BMI overnight just changed?
I think it was 98, 96 or 98. Yes, like, I do. I remember that vividly.
Like people that were in one category just overnight were in the next one over or something. Yeah. Like, wait a minute, what?
And automatically 6 point something million people became eligible for drugs and services and other types of medical money making that weren't eligible the night before. And also all of those people all of a sudden had this automatic label of your body's wrong, right? Yeah. You were fine. You were normal. You were ideal. And I hope you hear my sarcasm with the normal and ideal.
Right.
And then you go to bed and you wake up and all of a sudden your body has been defined very differently.
Yeah. And like maybe you would have qualified for whatever procedure you were going in for like 2 days before, but 2 days later, no.
Yep.
You need bariatric surgery to get it. Like, what's happening?
Yeah. I don't know if you've explored that, but just on the side note here with the weight stigma conspiracy theory, if you want to go into that land, the medical committee that advised the group that voted on that BMI shift actually advised against making that shift in BMI because the research didn't support it in terms of the health outcomes associated with the BMIs that they were lowering it to. But I think it was a committee of 13 people that just vote on it, and every single one of them was backed by the diet industry or the pharmaceutical industry. And so literally at that point in history, we decided to, instead of going with like scientific recommendations about what was actually in the best interests of people's health and how it was associated with their weight and BMI, we instead, you know, went with this private committee that voted. And every single person had conflicts of interest that would significantly impact the amount of money that they could make based on that recommendation. And it still floors me because we have decisions made like this today. It's not surprising, I guess, but like the amount of influence that these major money-making companies have over our very intimate personal relationships with our body. Yeah. Like how we view ourselves, whether or not we view our bodies as trustworthy or wise or deserving, whether or not we view ourselves as allowed to be or in need of surveillance and changing. It's so motivated by these forces outside ourselves that are just making, literally making things up, not even based on convincing science. As a scientist, that really irks me.
Well, it's just horrible too, because I remember just part of what triggered me all the time going to the doctors was that BMI chart was like right on the wall, huge, and I'd be sitting there waiting for the doctor and I'd be like looking at it and evaluating myself and okay, and the perfectionistic eating disorder part of my brain was like, okay, I want to get into this category. You know, like it wreaks havoc on you and it weighs on you. And to your point is, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm unhealthy. Something's wrong with my body. And then you get a lecture from the doctor. And when it's, I think we were talking before we hit record about not being believed by your doctor either. Yeah. Like maybe even coming in for help and being like told you're a liar. Like there's no way your body could be such and such size or in this BMI category if you're only eating this much or doing this or not doing. It's like, you're just constantly being told you're doing something wrong or like you're not doing enough or you're doing too much or you're, it's my gosh, like, where does it end?
Yeah, I saw that over and over in the work that the research that I did with folks with atypical anorexia. I had patients who would like tell their doctors, like, look, I have a history of this eating disorder. I'm mostly recovered now, but I don't want to diet because of this. And they would be like, you never had anorexia. You must have binged. Because they're just looking at the person in front of them and making assumptions without ever asking them, what did that look like for you?
Yeah.
And I saw that even more pronounced for the BIPOC participants in my study, where people who were not white had white doctors telling them like what their story with their body was. And one of my older, tell two stories from that study about like people just missing the mark. One was an older client, and this client had actually, I think she was a nurse when she was practicing. She was in retirement. She was in her 60s, and she had the experience of having increased difficulty walking. And when she talked about this with her doctors just kept telling her to lose more and more weight. This was during a time when she was still struggling with this atypical anorexia. And eventually she collapsed at a medical facility, and people came and helped her. And they found out then that she had spinal stenosis. So her nerves were literally not connecting in her body. And that is why she had trouble walking. Not because of her body size, not because of how much she weighed, but because her nerves were literally not connecting. But she went for 4 years with symptoms, with no one listening to her, because she was a woman, she was older, and she was in a larger body. That's what I take out of that. And similarly, there's another person in our study who was in a larger body, was walking on a beach in flip-flops, stepped on her foot a little bit wrong, and heard this pop, and all of a sudden could not bear weight on that foot. And she presented to an emergency room to get an x-ray. They wouldn't give her an x-ray, but they did diagnose her with high blood pressure from the pain that she was in, gave her a diet and discharged her, said that she probably had plantar fasciitis from being in a larger body. She ended up, for 6 weeks, she sought care. She went to six different medical facilities for different appointments, trying to get an x-ray for her foot. Meanwhile, she was a teacher in an elementary school, walking on that foot every day. She described it as surviving on caffeine and Tylenol for a month and a half. And after a month and a half, she finally goes in for what she thinks is going to be an x-ray. And instead of an x-ray, she gets 19 vials of blood drawn. She gets a DEXA scan. She gets tested for cancer, for pregnancy, for urine analysis. Like, she got a complete workup except an x-ray. And when all of her labs came back beautiful, that's when they finally were like, okay, we'll do an x-ray. And it turned out that she had broken her foot 6 weeks before and had been walking on it now for 6 weeks.
Oh my God.
And the biases that we have in our medical system of, if you're in pain, it's because of your weight. If you're having a symptom, it's because of your weight. If, like, everything, we call it fat broken arm syndrome in the fat acceptance community, that whatever it is, it comes to, I could have broken my arm and my doctor would still tell me to lose weight to fix it. But that's exactly what both of these people experience, and the amount of time they lived in pain because nobody would listen to them. And that comes with that implicit assumption that it's okay. Like, if you're in a larger body, you deserve to be in pain, or you should be in pain, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there's kind of like subtle message behind that. And we see that with women too. Women's pain is devalued compared to men's pain. And we know that in the research. Mm-hmm. People pay more attention. But yeah, and anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, but absolutely.
No, it's important to talk about too, because, and, right, if someone presents in a larger body, right, and I think you were talking about this, like, people are eating, like, people who have anorexia,
yeah,
a lot of times will write down every little morsel they eat, right? So
yes,
they know how much they're eating to a t- and they go to the doctor, and like you, they were told, oh, diet and exercise more. They're prescribing the symptom, right? It's
yes,
like,
yeah,
they're already eating so little and probably exercising a lot. It's to be told, go do more of that.
Yes.
It's like, how much less can you eat? How much more can you exercise? It's wow, that's horrible. Because when that's under the radar, doctors are not aware of the fact that someone can be in a larger body and have anorexia. Like, that's horrible.
Yeah.
You're basically telling someone, go continue doing what you're doing, but more.
Yeah. I had patients tell me that their doctors said, whatever you're doing, whatever you're eating, cut it in half, without ever asking, what they were eating in the first place. And can just, I would you ever look at someone with low weight anorexia and tell them that? No, no. And I don't know. And it is one of the projects I'm working on right now, actually has to do with how we train physicians to look for and identify eating disorder, and looking at, like, where are the holes in our medical curriculum that result in doctors not much less regular people, but doctors not understanding that no matter what size body you are in, if you are starved, there are consequences. And for the fattest person that exists on our planet, if we were to withhold food from them, like, they could go into a state of malnourishment. And for whatever reason, cough weight stigma, we so closely associate food and body size that it's really hard for us to get in our minds that can happen. Even though we know, right, with someone who might struggle with alcoholism, we can see malnutrition in someone who struggles with alcoholism. Even when they're getting an okay number of calories a day, quote unquote, but if they're not getting the nutrition that they need in those calories, they can be in a form of a place of malnutrition. For someone in a larger body with anorexia, they can be as medically compromised and sometimes more than mm-hmm. someone in a smaller body, depending on how long they've been in that place, what percentage of their weight they've lost, how quickly that weight loss has occurred, and just the genetic and epigenetic factors that make our bodies react differently to starvation depending on who we are and who our ancestors were. Thinking about these things, one of the stories I heard from a patient, she had gone in and her outpatient care team for her eating disorder was at a place where they realized, like, we can no longer safely treat you. Like, you need a higher level of care. And so they had done all the referral work. She had gotten into a higher level of residential program. And she needed those, like, initial labs and EKG that they require of every patient to make sure that they're medically stable enough to go into a residential program instead of needing a hospital. And when she went to her physician, her primary care doctor, who didn't know a lot about eating disorders, she asked for the labs and for the EKG, and her doctor said no. Her doctor was like, I see that you need this, but she was like, I know you don't want to know your weight, but I'm just going to tell you, your BMI is in the ideal category. Like, metabolically, your BMI looks perfect. There's no way that your labs would show something was messed up with where you're at. And so I don't want to waste resources running these labs and doing an EKG with knowing that, like, you're doing okay. And I want to reassure you that you're doing okay. And so this young woman had said, okay, my stomach does feel a little weird. So will you, before I leave, will you do, like, just an exam on my stomach, make sure things okay? And the doctor did an exam and found pitting edema in her abdomen, which can indicate things like heart failure and fluid retention in your thoracic cavity. And it's not good. It's a very serious complication of pretty severe starvation. And this research participant said when my doctor saw that, her eyes turned to golf balls. And she said, oh my gosh, there's a disease I didn't know was a disease. And before she was even allowed to leave the medical office, they had to run all the labs and wait for the results to make sure that she was mm-hmm. medically stable enough to drive home. Wow. And I share this story because that doctor had a big mistake and a big misstep, right? Like, she could have sent home this patient that was very ill, having just invalidated her need for treatment, invalidated her eating disorder, and reassured her that she was just fine. But she saw the medical symptoms, she saw what was happening for this patient, realized that, hey, there's something going on that I didn't know, right? Yeah. I thought anorexia looked like this. It also evidently looks like this. And that doctor has since become a huge advocate for helping other people realize, hey, this is what this can look like, and here's how we can help. I don't know. I love that story because it helps me hold out hope for people that just don't know what they don't know yet. And, yeah. And like, huge kudos to that patient who was willing to, instead of just cry and walk out the door, and we've talked about that a few times today, right? Yeah. Like, gently push back and see what happens. And in this case, luckily, she was able to get the care that she needed.
Thank goodness. But there's so many stories of people that did walk out feeling defeated, didn't get the care they needed. And maybe someone listening, maybe that's you. And I think we do need to keep having these conversations. Mm-hmm. And the reason I do want to have these things said is because I think if you don't hear these, you might think it was just your isolated experience. And I want to normalize it and say, you can go find another doctor. Mm-hmm. These things do happen. And it's, don't be quiet. Keep, something is wrong with your body. You know that something's hurting. You know that you need help. There will be a doctor, hopefully, that will take you seriously and hear all of these stories, because they do happen, unfortunately, and it's not you. There is, unfortunately, like you said, this weight stigma in the medical field. They don't get trained in medical school, but there's also societal weight stigma. And there's so much unknown about eating disorders, and people really think they know by looking at somebody what's going on, and they don't. I'm so glad you're doing all this research too. So needed. So you also work with people, is that right?
Yeah.
Clinically. And so if people do, you're fascinating, and I think you'd probably be great to work with. So if people do want to find you and work with you, how can they do that?
So I don't do one-on-one clinical work. I should back up. So I do some outpatient online therapy groups with Opal Food and Body Image, which is, Opal Food and Body Wisdom. I misspoke there, which is a weight inclusive treatment center in Seattle, Washington. And so they do eating disorders and they take a weight inclusive view the whole way through for patients. I love that work because many patients that have been told like you're not sick enough or you don't meet whatever cutoff are able to find clinicians who get it there. So I do work, my clinical work is mainly through them. And then I do also, I host community office hours once a week, or not once a week, once a month. See, I'm misspeaking all over the place. But once a month on Friday mornings, I do, like your professor has like nerdy office hours. Like you can be that nerdy community member that comes to open office hours with a professor. We just do it once a month. So it's specifically not students and academics that come. It's patients from the community. It's providers from the community. And it's just like people who are interested in topics of weight stigma and atypical anorexia. I think you have my email, but you can feel free to share that. So if you're, if people are interested in coming to those office hours, it's just a drop in. There's a little link. I can email it to you. And we just nerd out on things, eating disorders, weight stigma, atypical anorexia, whatever folks want to talk about that day.
That's fantastic. Love it. I will put that all in the show notes. So thank you for your willingness to share that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Any last final words before we end?
No, I'm so glad that you're doing this work and encouraging people who are out there that might not have either recognized that they had an eating disorder prior to hearing that maybe they can, even if they don't look like the stereotypical patient, or if they have known for a long time but haven't been able to get care. I'm glad that they have a resource in your podcast. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Thanks. You're doing great work, and I'm really glad you came on and talked about this. So thank you so very much for your time. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network, and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please rate and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.